Is there something about Green Book that offends you? This is what I'm trying to get to.
Offend? Are you British?
Yeah.
Are you British?
I am.
Let me give you a British answer. It was my cup of tea. Not my cup of tea!
Hello and welcome to the show. My name is Donovan, Donovan Morgan Grant, and I am joined by Mr. Harrison Chute.
Hello.
And this is Questions We Don't Have Answers. The two of us have been podcasting for some years now. Harry's been analyzing sci-fi on a social-political scale, and I've done shows on superhero comic books and superhero comic book media. So we've been in the podcasting game for a while, but thought we'd like to up our ante and try to talk about things that really matter. Things that people try to talk about but tend not to. Sociology, society, culture, race.
We need food.
So the purposes of this podcast is to have as honest and uncompromising a discussion as humanly possible. So hopefully this podcast will brought...
Excuse me.
Explode.
Explode the world.
Broaden your mindset and give way to critical thinking, because critical thinking is where it all begins. So sit back, enjoy, and give us your thoughts once you hear our takes on the subject matters of today.
Welcome back to Questions We Don't Have Answers. One of the questions on my mind is, what is the difference between us and them? Well, don't be so quick to answer that question. I just mean liberals and conservatives, you know, the old the old black and white, you know,
Cain binary. And Abel.
Yeah, exactly. his words. But, you know, I've always felt that the difference was self-reflection, that conservatives, especially nowadays, the sort of Republicans that we see are just sort of so, I don't know, like unflappable in their increasingly absurdist beliefs and where they place their heart. And you just think, well, why can't you just sort of see this for what it is? But then perhaps examine the plank in your own eye, because, you know, there's definitely issues that we kind of got to sort out on the home team. And I think it's become urgent that we do so as we head into sort of a political, another one of those moments in history. So Donovan, tonight, the question is, when is social justice dishonest? How have you been, buddy, pal, friend, foe?
You again. When is social justice dishonest? It is what it is. Yeah, it's an interesting kind of thing to talk about. I forget when exactly the Oscars were, and I don't necessarily think the Oscars are, like, you know, the greatest, like, talking point in the world, but a sort of big lightning rod of this discussion can talk about the whole Green Book thing, it winning over over The Favorite. No. which I've not seen. Well, I'd like to see. I've been well. This is one of those things where I'm trying not to learn to hate anymore, and so when certain things like cancel culture, call it culture, whatever, or, you know, millennial colloquialisms come up in terms of this conversation, it's not so much the language in itself as it is, you know, the engagement with this type of conversation, because I don't feel that anyone does it better than we do, or at least as earnestly. And I think, you know, in this kind of era of caring where we are, caring about the future, morally, I think that, like, there's been a lot of good in just being hyper aware of how we qualify things, how we characterize things, how we view certain things. But I think with that sense of urgency comes sort of an itchy trigger finger. And we've discussed this before several times on the podcast. I think the last time we talked about it in earnest was probably the James Gunn thing, maybe the Henry Cavill episode. Both dated. But I think when it says social justice is honest, there are a few case studies for this that we can kind of bring up. I've already mentioned Green Book. And it's one of those things where, for now, I'll say that, like, the answer just might be we can't stop trying to figure things out in this way, even if it ends up being wrong or being too aggressive, because the effort is going to take us towards a type of understanding. I don't think people are wholly satisfied with the way we figure out the morality of certain things now, because we understand it to be flawed, but we also understand it to be sort of on a time crunch. And so I think sort of trying to slow down the clock might help us sort of see things faster. Let's give it a shot.
We tried to record this podcast last week, but there were some technical difficulties. I want to say, but I'm not sure about one of these, that in that time, James Gunn was rehired by Disney for Guardians 3, and Joss Whedon announced a new show. Why is it that the guys that I want to get canceled never get canceled?
I never heard about the Joss Whedon thing. I was within the last 4 or 5 days, the James Gunn thing was resolved with him getting not only Suicide Squad 2, but also Guardians 3. That was interesting, and I was surprised, and I was watching something today that said, logistically, this probably was confirmed to have happened about 2 or 3 months ago, but just kind of ironed out because the Disney's holdover Fox and everything like that, and sort of the absorption of Fox has just been settled. And I think for some reason, Gunn's firing and rehiring, they didn't want to have that be impacted in any negative way. But I mean, I'll ask you, how are you feeling about that at this point?
I mean, I was definitely upset when I heard, just because that's how it would be. I mean, it's just like he's falling upwards so hard. It's like the scene in Willy Wonka where they're floating up towards the fan and they're like, oh, don't go into the fan. I don't know. That's the visual of this guy with his thick glasses and his gelled hair. I don't know. It's just, I mean, it's like, it's whatever. Like, he's not a bad guy, I don't think. He's not like Joss Whedon or anything like that. But it's just weird. Like, I think it's the reaction to people like James Gunn and other contemporaries that really just so threw me off. And I've always kind of hated this guy, like, since 2010, I would say. And so, like, it's just whenever, like, I wouldn't think about that name a lot, but when it was sort of this negative association. And so to have him be, like, embraced by people for making movies that they like, that's fine, but to then become this sort of, like, lodestone for, like, to become the exception to the rule, like, it was just so, I still can't really parse it. Like, what makes him so different than Kevin Hart, for example? That was definitely the subject of an earlier podcast. And mm-hmm. what I could not give voice to on that podcast, because I hadn't quite figured it out yet, and believe me, I've been thinking about it ever since, was this frustration and this sort of brewing suspicion that we might be, like, there's a lot of suspicion when it comes to, you know, cancel culture and outrage culture and all these quote-unquote titles we have for things. Understandable, you know, suspicion around it that I think is not always worth giving attention to. But I think part of what it might be doing in terms of, like, infecting our language or our sort of our verbs or whatever, our interactions with the world, is sort of shaping it such that, like, we might be sort of whitewashing ourselves, that, mm-hmm. you know, in order to be on the team, we have to kind of be perfect, or that, you know, to, in scrutinizing these celebrities, are we sort of creating this perfect ideal human that we're all trying to aspire to? And there's a lot of selective perception that goes on, because nobody is good, but we just accept people because we haven't heard anything about them yet. And we're going to, like, with Kevin Hart, like, he made those horrible homophobic jokes in 2011. That was 4 years before the legalization of gay marriage in the US. It's not to say that there weren't people fighting for marriage equality before 2015 or even 2011. But I think 2011 was also, oh no, that was the year that transgender was taken off the APA, or not the APA, the DSM-5 as a fucking mental disorder. Right. I think it was like 73 for homosexuality. But I mean, that was still the Stone Ages, right? And I don't want to forget that we were shitty then. And judge other, I think, okay, my concern is that in judging other people, what are we making of ourselves, right? Are we mm-hmm. putting ourselves on that higher post?
Yeah, that's interesting, because like, I was listening to Wesley Morris's podcast. What is the name of the show? The Mirror Tip of My Fingertips. Scrolling. Still processing with Wesley Morris and Jenna Wortham, two culture writers for the New York Times. Both black. as hell. Nice. And I was listening to them kind of like kind of reconcile with Finding Neverland, and really talking about kind of like in a Ta-Nehisi Coates way, because in how Ta-Nehisi Coates eulogized Kanye West. It's kind of like saying, like, you know, this whole thing with Michael Jackson and this documentary, it is not so simple just to cancel Michael Jackson or his music, because virtually all of modern black music and much of black culture is black music has been legacied and carried down from like the sort of family tree of Motown and Michael Jackson. You just can't, you know, point to Bruno Mars, you're mimicking Michael Jackson, that's problematic. It doesn't work that way. You have to kind of come to grips with yourself, but you have to recognize that, like, the massive influence isn't just, it's kind of just like the history of a country. You know, there are, you know, where it comes from, the influence is there, and the influence is in Beyonce, the influence is in a lot of hip hop, a lot of R&B, like Frank Ocean. So it's a lot to kind of contend with when you're it's not just somebody that you liked, but somebody that an icon of an entire culture, part of the culture, somewhat the culture, is being recontextualized in a way that's different because A, he's dead, and two, it's a different thing than R. Kelly or Bill Cosby. So there was a lot of this. There's a lot of interesting discussion in terms of, you know, what does it say of us when we want to be good people contending with this part of ourselves, and these are questions that, like, we've never had to ask ourselves before. I don't know if anybody. I don't want to say no anybody, because obviously, you know, I feel that, like, we're kind of the hardcore reboot of the 1970s, where there was a lot of like if you read comic books in the 70s, more so than ever, there was a lot of social change and sort of like progressive politics being ushered in. Whether it was the drug arc in Amazing Spider-Man 97, 98, 99, whether it was the award-winning Green Arrow, Green Lantern series that was canceled, talking about racism and overpopulation and environmental issues and drug abuse, there was just a lot of concern that was purported in the media back then about social issues, and I feel that, like, that's really happening now. It's always happening, but, like, I feel that's happening in much earnest now, because we're sort of people with different voices and people with different backgrounds are discovering platforms where they can kind of get those voices and concerns across, whether it's, you know, the increasingly black Oscars each year, because it's been like 2 years since Moonlight won Best Picture.
Yeah.
You know, they had Get Out win Best Screenplay. You have all this stuff, and shows like Atlanta and Insecure and Blackish and now Boomerang's just come out. Like, this is an era where we cannot look at the past to figure things out. It's just not tenable. So we have to kind of really have faith in ourselves to figure out what people mean when certain things are done. Obviously, you know, you gotta call evil how you seize it, whether it comes from Judge Jeanine Pirro, whether it comes from Lauren Ingram, whether it comes from Tucker Carlson, you know, our Rose Gallery. But sometimes I feel even something that you genuinely disagree with, I feel that, like, if you say for this reason they must be gone, that's not contributing to large conflict. That's attacking the symptom but not the cause. Like, today I read that, like, Bernie Sanders was at some rally and said that there's a difference between guns in urban areas and guns in rural areas, and immediately, you know, alarm bells start ringing. But as much as I don't really care for Bernie Sanders, I don't think he knows what he's talking about in that instance, because he's an old man. So it's one of those things where, like, you know, you would like a Van Jones. Oh, no way, he was canceled. you would like somebody to say this is how to kind of bridge that gap. I mean, he went on The Breakfast Club of all places to talk about you know, running for president again, and Charlamagne the God asked him, like, black people have a lot of concerns that you're not going to carry their concerns into the future with your campaign. How can you alleviate? What have you done for the community? And I remember him kind of hemming and hawing a lot. So it's one of those things where it's like, you know, again, don't exactly pull the trigger, but just kind of just whilst people are in our moral custody, take time sort of to rehabilitate them and re-educate them, Clockwork Orange style.
Exactly. If there's any movie that we should take examples from as role models, Clockwork Orange.
Of course.
I mean, I think, Jamie, first of all, Van Jones has been canceled a lot, but I feel like if there's one person who just we cannot sort of engage with that way, it's Van Jones. Like, his mission is all about, like, you know, national unity. And that looks kind of gross a lot of the time, but I just want to hear him out, you know, at least for a while. But anyway, with Bernie Sanders, like that example, it's interesting because when you say that, like, he says, you know, there's a difference between guns in urban versus rural areas, like, there's it's almost like our minds have, like, added this, like, plug-in that's, like, an extra barrier or something that we have to sort of pass through that's, like, pass-fail. Like, is this okay or not before we even sort of take it apart? And so, yes, like, certainly part of the problem with outrage culture is this sort of, like, cheapening of our perceptions of things, and it's helping us not think about things critically. It's sort of giving us a pass to just say, like, oh, well, I don't like that or whatever. And obviously that is sort of core to the conservative criticism of outrage culture, that, like, oh, people just aren't experiencing things because they're pussies. But with Bernie Sanders, like, that's an interesting idea that he poses. I would like to at least hear more about that. I'm never going to look into it, but, you know, that sounds like it could be sort of dimensional. But if I'm offended by it, and offense is a real thing, then I am sort of closed off from it. So there's two questions there, which is, like, how do you sort of overcome that in yourself, but also how do you package ideas in a way such that they do not cause offense? Is that even theoretically possible? Because if the idea is offensive, then maybe there's something you could do about it. Counterpoint, I've always believed that it's important to sort of, like, quote unquote, come out whole on the other side, and you know, not to, like, to not just, like, shoot people down or whatever, not cancel people out of hand. But it really seems like a lot of the people that at least I follow on Twitter are sort of, like, in it with both feet in terms of, like, cancel culture, and, like, we just got to push forward, which makes me think that that's just how it's going to be, and we're sort of, like, asking all the wrong questions right now, because it's like, what if people slip through the cracks? What if the wrong people get canceled in, like, 2024? Is that going to matter if we have, like, clean energy legislation or whatever, and if things actually happen, if there is gun control, like, reasonable gun control and all
sacrifices
that stuff?
Sacrifices must be made.
I mean, like, what if that's right? Because I think a lot of people are already there. And so what if they're right? Do you believe that we can get there? Well, first of all, do you believe that we can get there without sort of irresponsible canceling, or for lack of a better term? And if you do not, then, or if you do believe that, then is that even a question worth asking, basically?
Of course, yeah, I think it's a very worthy question, and I feel that, like, we can do it, because I don't necessarily agree with the overall online, you know, Court of Public Appeals statement that Aziz Ansari was screwed over, but that was at least an attempt to say, this is not an open and shut case, and we are not... You know, we deem this instance as, you know, whatever, however we deem it as. It's not always an automatic dismissal. There's an effort to try to take things from a case-by-case basis. And that effort's inconsistent. But I feel as though, especially lately, with, like, the whole the Jussie Smollett debacle, and I guess now there's doubt on the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard thing.
For fuck's sake.
Like, I'm not getting into that, but like, the point is that, like, I feel as though that, like, recently there's been a lot of situations that have kind of halted the impotence to come up with, like, you know, an automatic response to certain things. Like, even the Covington kids things, which, again, I have no heart or sympathy for them whatsoever, but people are taking it as an example, like, we should not rush to judgment, which I think is a good call. I don't believe in just, okay, we have to sacrifice whoever we have to so we can get these things taken care of. But at the same time, there are so many people. I mean, I was surprised that, like, Tucker Carlson was, like, you know, took some time off, or, like, Jenny Pirro got her show taken off, because on the right, there is no accountability whatsoever. I mean, just freaking today, like, Kellyanne Conway is defending the president for, like, haranguing her husband online. Yep. Like, what kind of timeline is this? Like this is insane. And like, I don't think anybody actually cares about, like, the Conways in terms of, like, you know, actual people, and, like, you know, whether they should be protected or not. But it's one of those things where it's like, this is, you want to know what's up with that. But there's, I feel as though that, like, when it comes to that arena of people, there's just not enough making them going away. So as a sort of emotional catharsis, we have become a lot more vigilant and cutthroat on our side. And, like, I feel that, you know, we always talk about education in this way. We always talk about trying to make people understand. We have to do that. You know, I'm not seeing a scenario where we just have to, like, just, you know, if we can't convince the person, like let's say we can't, you know, actually talk to a Tommy Lauren, we have to talk to, like, people who are inclined to listen to her, or inclined to, if not even believe her, but at least, you know, give her the time of day and say, look, this is how she is being harmful. We have to find someone to talk to, rather than just talking at people or telling people. That's gotta be a thing. That has to be a practice, because we're going to go into certain things. Okay, maybe we've achieved gun control, maybe we've achieved fight against climate change, but those types of issues won't be the all or nothing every day. We have to discover the skill for nuance and the talent for reason, so that we can, you know, have a dimension of tools and skills to apply to any some sort of problem. You know, not everything needs a pickaxe or even an axe. Some things people need a scalpel. So yeah, I'm really urging a call for restraint and honest consideration, just as practice, just as self-training. Because I was, you know, and again, certain things, you know, that's not saying that everything is not wrong. Many things are wrong. Fuck Tucker Carlson. But when it comes to, when you see somebody that like you really admire or believe in, or at least have no bad opinion on, don't just instantly believe that they are, you know, they're, you know, I don't know. Like, there was a thing like last night where Daniel Caesar, who I mentioned in the year review, he went on some strange thing. I'm not sure exactly what this is about, but, like, he was defending somebody and basically called out black people, saying, you know, oh, black people are this, that, and the third, or whatever, him being black. And so he was trending, saying, like, oh, well, he ain't even that cute, or like, you know, oh, he sucks, or whatever. And it's like, again, like, you know, I Daniel Caesar is not Barack Obama. So it means less. There's less on the line to actually take time out to, like, you know, bridge that gap. Now, I understand that, like, you know, he has a following, so people might follow what he says. But, like, I don't see, you know, I feel proportionally he's not as high stakes as a Kanye West. And I feel that's you know, that's an instance where, you know, just a calmer head is called for, as to choose an example.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and when you say something like, you know, people should use a scalpel rather than with an axe, if you were to ask somebody, you know, if they do that and they say, oh, well, it's not necessary, or I already do, or something like that's then an example of somebody who does not have a good skill set for self-reflection. And that's sort of the issue, I think, at the heart of this is, like, are we entering into this as our best selves? And I think that's definitely part of what you were saying, and was able to persuade me, because I honestly didn't know, but I think I'm with you on that. And you know, with, like, guys like Tucker Carlson, like, when you say, you know, we need to practice restraint and everything, like, that doesn't just mean never criticize somebody. That just means, you know, consider it and be able to draw the distinction between a Daniel Caesar and a Kanye West. And that comes from reasoned judgment. and perhaps some. But it's like the price to get there is like you have to be so jaded because you've experienced so much, and
you can't. I'm sorry, but like you can't just ask that of everybody because everybody's different experiences are going to color their perception of what's urgent and what's not differently. My background and my experiences and my history have, I think, given me time and space to approach certain things certain ways. And I'll end up being a hypocrite over certain things, but I genuinely do want to try to learn and try to expand possibilities on certain scenarios, because I feel there are too many times where I just feel uncomfortable with the level of, we've all found a new pariah, in the name of what's good, because Tucker Carlson has a history, so it's an easier call to make than a Beto or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's kind of where we begin to think about motives, and honestly begin to sort of suspect things, because it's like, well, why are you doing this? And not to say that the this is always so bad, but it's like, I mean, really, like, why are we sort of dogpiling this person? And is it because of some sort of catharsis, or, you know, it's like, why do we as a society pursue law enforcement? Is it to punish people, or is it to prevent crimes from happening? And that's, I feel like there's part of both in all of us. And so then with something like Green Book, we have a perfect example of whatever the inverse of a role model is, where it's like, we never want to be self-congratulating and be like, yes, I am not that guy. Like, I am better than this, and therefore I'm not racist or sexist because I'm not as racist or sexist as this guy, who is now canceled. Haha. I did see a tweet today that said that, like, when people talk about canceling, it's usually like about a guy who has sort of hurt like women and women of color and sort of minority groups like that, and they're not saying that they're like canceled or whatever that means, but that they're pulling out support, basically. And granted, it's kind of a presumptuous tweet because it's speaking for literally everybody, but I think that that's still worth investigating. And so, Donovan, tell me, I missed the Oscars. What did win Best Picture?
Best Animated Feature? Into the Spider-Verse, of course.
You know that's not what I asked.
Damn you. Well, if you listen to the upcoming, as of this recording, episode of Gotham Chronicle, you'll find out that we found out that it was Green Book Live. Bertone just got done editing that.
Nice.
And it's funny because I had heard a mild scuttlebutt of Green Book, like very mild, like very much on sort of the ridges of conversation. But the fact of the matter is that Green Book was very much sort of this Help-esque, sort of like nostalgia waxened period piece about racial tolerance and the word that Morris used, racial reconciliation, I think it was.
Interesting. Yeah.
And it's a genre of storytelling that seeks to purport healing the divide and showing and confronting racism in period pieces where it's easy to distinguish yourself from the past, where Viggo Mortensen plays an Italian gangster, kind of like driver for Mahershala Ali, who's a very kind of cultured bisexual black man in the South, and Viggo Mortensen's racist, but he's not so racist that he's a Klan member or whatever. So when he's confronted with that, he becomes friends with Mahershala Ali over fried chicken, and they I've heard the audio.
Oh my god!
And all this kind of stuff, and it's very easy to say, well, Viggo Mortensen has learned his lesson, and he's not as bad as those other kinds of white people, just like I am not as bad as those other kinds of white people.
Yep.
That's kind of how it is already is right now. I've just encountered so many people who are wrong, thinking that they are perfectly fine because they don't put on masks and go out in the night, riding horses and shit, or saying the Jews will not replace us. And like that's and to, the most concerning thing to me was that, you know, we had several racial concerned movies when it came, like Black Panther is a movie about race, you know, like blah blah blah, you know, jokes about the name blah blah blah, black superhero. Seriously, that's a directly explicitly anti-racist film. Whether it should have won the Oscar or not, like that's what the film was about. It's not just a Marvel movie. Black Klansman, the whole point of that film is pretty much boiled down in the last 5 minutes, where all the bullshit that they go up against is contextualized in sort of showing footage from the Charlottesville rally and the guy running people over with his car, and the silence that happened in the theater when that played on screen. I feel like there was another film, a third film. If Bill Street Could Talk, which wasn't up for Best Picture, but like that's a James Baldwin work, which I've not read, but I would like to. Like that's in James Baldwin was always concerned with identity and race. You've had these very nuanced racial stories told and produced and presented by Black people. So when you have a very kind of cliched, feel-goody film produced entirely by white people, that sends the message that A, racism is easy to kind of, you know, come to grips with, and two, this is a much more profound and fundamentally educational story. This story right here, which is like, you know, 101, compared to the much harsher but ultimately much longer lasting lessons of a Black Klansman or If Beale Street Could Talk. And that's why people, because I've heard people not understand, you know, I thought Green Book was a good movie. I don't it's giving a message. I don't get what's the big deal, because what you know, what would you expect for this kind of period story? What would you, because it was tangentially based off a true story, and it's like, well, what would you expect for the times to be? And it's not so much, I think people are saying it's not exactly that the film shouldn't be made, but it shouldn't be recognized in this higher tier of sociological sophistication, because no one should mistake race for being anything other than an incredibly, probably the most incredibly complex conflict within our modern society that we still have not gotten beyond, and we can't get beyond tomorrow, because there are hundreds of years of build up towards figuring out how to handle these things. You know, we're not going to be we're far away off from that Judgment Day comic with like the black astronaut I talked about like a couple years back, and it, a lot of people were comparing it to Crash. A lot of people, Morris compared it to Driving Miss Daisy, which won, whereas Do the Right Thing, which also talked about modern racism, didn't win 30 years ago to the day.
He was so happy about that.
Yeah, so it's one of those things where like it's not so much a slight on Mahershala Ali, one of the best supporting actor, or Viggo Mortensen, or even I would even say like the idea to do the movie, but the movie should be seen in a less affecting context, and it's actually more harmful to kind of put it up there as a best picture of the year, because from all accounts I heard Roma was really great, I heard The Favorite was really great, I was going for Black Panther because I'm loyal like that. I don't know if I would have done Black Klansman, but like it would have been over Green Book. I think Vice is up for it. Same thing with Vice. I don't know. And from all accounts, like Green Book was in the same realm as a Bohemian Rhapsody, which in that it did not deserve a nomination.
Yeah, so surprised.
So there were a number of nominations for movies that could have done it. But the fact that like this is such a politically charged swath of nominations makes it much more of a talking point than, oh, that movie didn't deserve to win. It's beyond that. It's like, what is it saying about our society? What is our society comfortable with? And how is it characterizing social justice? Is it characterizing social justice by showing the dysphoria and imagination of Black people in Black Panther? Is it characterizing it through, you know, efforts of realities of the past and realities of the present? Or is it characterizing it in sort of this racial reconciliation, feel-good, you know, white guy saves the black guy day story as in Green Book? And that's what this is. That's what everyone's talking about.
It is kind of funny. I mean, there's been one of those movies every year, like if it was Three Billboards or American Sniper or La La Land, like going back like through the ages, I feel like. But it was never supposed to win, and this year it finally won. That movie that we all decided was not the one that was that's supposed to win. But it always comes close, but it never gets there. And finally it did. And so that's a really important distinction to draw in terms of like saying like what's wrong with the movie itself is sort of a red herring. It's not that. It's the whole thing. And isn't its ascension into the halls of the Chinese Man Theater, whatever it is, isn't that symptomatic of this greater cultural tendency to just be attracted to easy narratives? And so like the easy narrative is like, you know, oh, I am not racist because I'm not sort of physically violent in my racism. And you know, and to like extend that to where I was coming from in the beginning, it's like, who the fuck are you? Like, I don't give a shit about Kevin Hart. Honestly, I don't know him. He's a celebrity, and where we're at in 2019 is fuck all celebrities, fuck all people that we just don't know. But who are you to judge him when you were, if you were a straight dude, 1000% homophobic in 2011, and probably still are, as I, you know, probably still am. I do have a gay friend. His name is Peter.
I was about to say, hi, Peter.
Hi, Peter.
Don't listen to him.
He doesn't listen to this podcast. It's okay. But and so like, there's an interesting analogy being drawn here, right? In terms of easy narratives and something that's actually worthwhile. And so like, what is the, how do we analogize out to Black Panther for our lives? Like, how do we have those conversations rather than buying into the easy narrative of Green Book?
How we have the conversation of like in terms of like what Black Panther was trying to say, because I feel that is that what you mean?
Kind of like, you know, how do we sort of like do what Black Panther did for worldview and communication in our own lives? I guess in terms of, you know, problematizing or not problematizing, but complicating the reconciliation or whatever it will be.
Well, that's interesting because like with Black Panther, especially with that story, and it's interesting because there is because it's told, you know, by Ryan Coogler and Joe Robert Cole with Black characters, there is a natural and instantly understood understanding that racism is real. You know, from the very first scene, you have Sterling K. Brown talk about, you know, they've assassinated their leaders, they've driven them all into poverty, all that kind of stuff. We can save Black Americans, and basically what Killmonger is trying to do. It's like, you don't have to explain any of that. You don't need a history lesson. You automatically know what they're talking about. And, like, it's not just Black audiences, it's everybody. Kind of in the same way that Get Out, you know, you can just see how instantly awkwardness and uncomfortable, you know, being uncomfortable turns into, like, fear with Chris and, you know, and that family in that movie. So it's like kind of characterizing race in a certain recognizable box kind of creates a distance that actually doesn't always exist, because there's not always confusion when it comes from, there's not hardly any confusion when it comes to race in certain contexts. Like you have what's his name? Martin Freeman's character, who doesn't really challenge anything that, like, you know, in terms of, he doesn't really have a voice in terms of like the larger question, the larger philosophical questions between T'Challa and Killmonger, but it's not necessarily discussed through the other characters aside from Wakabi, Daniel Kaluuya. I don't know if you saw it, but there was his best scene was actually cut out of the movie, but you can see it, the latest scene of him screaming about how Claude, Andy Serkis, you know, him murdering his parents and stuff, and how he represents the evil in the world that has to be stamped out. And yeah, there's going to be a lot of people dying, but in the end, it'll be beautiful because Wakanda's best, right? It was a fantastic scene that I'm sorry was cut, because a lot of people kind of complain, like, you know, that romance between him and Okoye felt really forced. But that scene, I thought, really underlined how strong those characters were. But it's just like you also have characters talk about the issue of, you know, a globalized sort of, you know, Black monarchy or globalized like Black supremacy, and, you know, like that puts into a context, like, you know, like they seem to have everything figured out, but they understand that they have to be separate, and you know why they have to be separate, but should that separating, is that really the good thing to do? And at the end they decide, well, no, you know, we have to be, and T'Challa says, basically to the camera, you know, we got to build bridges, not walls. We have to learn to live together in this world, you know, and share our resources. And we, you know, because we know what we can do when we're all together. Like, there's a lot of stuff. It's not just fucking Black Panther versus his evil opposite that I've heard some people say. Like, it really is. I think in terms of a writing level, it's Marvel's best film thematically, because it's if this was not a superhero film, it would still be great. I hope that, like, the sequel continues that kind of theme, because it's important to the narrative of a uncolonized Black country. You know, that shouldn't go away exactly. And they should also use a key, because he's a great villain, like Black Joker. But I think the proliferation of those conversations would obviously be interesting. It's more than like, because like, I remember in Blade, there's a line where Deacon Frost calls Blade and Uncle Tom, because he's like, you know, not trying to take over, like, you know, the Daywalker or the non-vampires world or whatever, and defends them. Like, there's a couple of lines here or there. It's not really a political film in that way. It's written by David Gore. But there are a couple of sly lines which at least suggest a hint of awareness that I think is always helpful, because you do have the kind of problem of like, you know, the Black Sidekick and the Falcon, the Black Sidekick and War Machine, and the Black Sidekick and Lashana Lynch. And I'm sure there's more coming up, as opposed to, like, you know, like a Miles Morales, who's like the black hero, and Peter Parker's his bitch. So yeah, I think that, like, the way to get those conversations out there is to, I mean, I don't want to say Green Book should never have been made, because I feel that's people will say that and have said that, and I don't see anything wrong with making that kind of story, but that story lacks the understanding of where we are right now and how normalize that basic conversation and basic statement is in the world and the mind of the white liberal and the white conservative. So it's, I suppose on the micro level, it is harmful just by perpetuating that falsehood of reality, as opposed to Black Panther, which is entirely realistic.
I mean, I think there's also the simpler answer, which is that Black Panther doesn't necessarily identify a white viewer in the process of, like, of, you know, that proxy. It's like it's telling a story where there are certain understandings and things already in place, whereas Green Book is like, this is a movie for white people, specifically the white voters who sort of dominate the Academy, and so, like, there, right, like, right there, that's sort of how you get that the easy narrative again. But with Black Panther, you know, as you're saying, like, there's all this sort of I mean, it's essentially a 102 almost, if, like, Green Book is sort of the 101 of, like, hey, racism is bad. But then it's like, okay, well, let's look at, like, you know, colonialism and sort of speculating on these things and asking big, like, the huge what if question. And that, I mean, like, that is sort of, I guess, in terms of the question at the heart of this podcast, it's like, why are those questions almost discomforting to a traditional Academy voter? Like, I mean, do you think that there's a problem with them or with the people thinking about them, and how do we make that bridge, I guess, to that 102 level?
Well, the whole conversation of like, you know, hashtag Oscars to white, which I think was around 2015, I feel that's just echoed from year to year, because even if the right Black movie didn't win this year, you still had Regina King won Best Supporting Actress, which I feel is a rarity. You know, I know that Octavia Spencer won a few years ago, but, you know, you had Black Panther win first awards ever for like I think that in terms of costuming, that was the first time a Black woman's ever won an award for that.
Wow.
You have I think there were a couple other firsts. I can't recall. Which is just kind of ongoing suggestion of a furthering conversation, and it's surprising, because I feel that, like, the Academy, I've always imagined it to be very, like, you know, I understand that the whole Oscars thing is basically sort of some sort of political thing to kind of drum up interest and contributions and financial donations to the industry. It's kind of a distraction. That's what people kind of brought up. You know, it's not really legitimate. But I've always assumed that the Academy is this very sophisticated, you know, kind of sect of people who know their movies, like, you know, Super Saiyan Roger Ebert's times 100 or whatever. But no, it really is a bunch of guys who are like, you know, oh, this made me feel good about my whiteness, so I'm going to vote for this movie. It's that simple. And we're always contending with the natural comfort level of the white mind and how that needs to be kind of navigated in a way to kind of bridge understanding. Because they go into Green Book thinking they already know the moral. They're not enlightened by Green Book. They're not like, wow, I guess I can be friends with my Mahershala Ali all along. Like, they're not being surprised by that. Which makes me think, I wonder if they even understood Black Panther on the level that they went for. I wonder if they did just kind of see it as Chadwick Boseman beating up Andy Serkis. like I don't necessarily think that Black Panther is like the world's most subtle film, but it's definitely more subtle than most Marvel films. While you know, on the right side, so maybe it's just not a level of understanding rather than, you know, and that what they don't understand, that they just kind of fall in line with what they're comfortable with.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that's definitely the main problem. And so I guess if we want to try to encourage people to not do that, I guess I would just ask you, and this is like, you know, one of those questions, but it's like, you know, how have you sort of found yourself outside your comfort zone in the social justice space in the past? And, you know, were there like stumbles, and did you sort of get there eventually or whatever? No.
Not, well, the answer is no. I mean, there are times where I feel that, like, I don't give a... Like, there are times when certain issues, especially when I was younger, about, you know, like oh, this is an all-black kind of thing, and I'm just like, I really don't care, because I don't really relate to this. I've kind of come out. It's like, you know, whether I do or not, someone is going to. And now there have been a lot more diverse voices, where you learn of the dimensionality of black voices. Whereas before, I don't think you did, but I think every now and then there is sort of the like eye rolling. Okay, you know, this is like I mentioned before. There's a, because I think a sequel called White Itself. There was a comic book called Black that was illustrated by this black comic writer, Jamal Igel, and I remember just thinking that book was horrible, because it was very anti-subtlety about the idea, like, what if black people around the world all were basically mutants. They had like superpowers, and white people were after them. And it just wasn't very well realized. It was kind of like a Blight-esque, misshapen world-building kind of thing that kind of wanted to be halfway Milestone Comics. And like this stuff, I don't think, you know, it's getting plauded because it's tackling race in a very like direct and unpleasant way, but like it's inartful and graceless in how it does it, so it's not really saying anything that's new or even deft. And for this reason, I feel on the outs, because I don't necessarily feel that it connects to me, but maybe it connects to somebody. And I feel that there are times where I resent that I have to give that caveat, because it's just like, you know, can't people just be smarter? But you know, I'm trying to kind of like tamper down my reactionary impatience with people, because I feel that is that kind of impatience that leads to indifference, and that indifference which leads to chasms in understanding. So you know, there's that. I was listening to a podcast review or podcast discussion of Into the Spider-Verse from people who are older than I am, like people are in their 40s and stuff, and they were mentioning, I mean, they really like the movie, but they were mentioning certain things that I never even knew were conversations, like the whole thing with charter schools and private schools and the whole conflict between, you know, a lottery system that kind of gets a kid into school, and how that system is ultimately racist. And this is also timely, talking about getting into schools. But like, how that's not confronted in the film, and I'm like, I didn't even heard of this or even thought that it would be a thing. Of course, the original comic book story was written by white Brian Michael Bendis, but Peter Ramsey was involved in the storytelling of Into the Spider-Verse, so he was learned about it, but I never knew about it, so obviously he didn't either. And like, is there even time to kind of confront that in a meaningful way? And like, you know, there was a lot of like hand wringing over Miles' father being a cop in this version, and someone really took offense to like the whole joke about, you know, you know, you gotta say I love you back, Miles. It's like, you know, you took a cop and had him demand his son that he say he loves him. How horrible. And I'm just like, I don't give a fuck.
Wait, which political leaning does that criticism come from?
It was just like, I really do not believe that children or young people or even most people are going to recognize that in an abusive context when it comes to police, because they are as a familial context. And I felt that was just like, you're not, you know, you're it feels like you're too close to this to kind of see the efficacy of the scene as a whole, whether it was, you know, whether it was ultimately good or bad. And then I'm thinking, well, am I biased because I didn't think of that way? And I still don't think I am, but like, it's a kind of like ping-ponging back and forth between the thought processes that I decry and hate so much, but it's gotten me some places.
Well, that's a perfect example, I think, of when this does become sort of more complex, is when we begin to suspect that people are looking at a lot of things like math problems, and it's like, well, does it contain a cop? Like, oh, well, that means that it's automatically bad. Or, you know, if you look at something like Kill la Kill, and luckily that came in like right before all this stuff started happening, but it's like the elevator pitch of Kill la Kill is like fucking horrifying. It's like naked high school girls fighting, but even the first episode is like really, you know, problematic. Like, that was definitely the word then, and it's still the word now.
The scene where Sin Kitts gets on Ryuko.
Yeah, exactly. Like, who knew that I would be shedding tears for him at the end? But like, you know, that's a really hard sell, and it's really problematic in a lot of ways. But, you know, if you, I guess I would just like feel bad if you were just like, well, I'm just not going to watch that then. And I'm sure that I've done that too. But, you know, I think that that's sort of like what's lost in that's like the nuance that we're chasing. It's like, well, what's underneath this scene where he's, you know, making his son say, I love you. Like, sure, that sounds bad, but context. And so why does context scare us? Is it because, Is it the old criticism coming from the other side that we're just so afraid of, like, other ideas? Well, this is the criticism that goes in all directions, I guess. But, you know, are we also afraid of, like, things that sort of contradict our narratives? You know, because, you know, I feel like the Green Book analogy is like, but we are all Green Book in a way that we all are attracted to easy narratives. And so when we find things that sort of challenge those, do we sort of retreat? And if so, how do we come back from that? I guess this is the next part.
I think that's exactly it. It's the whole, this is not my experience. This is negating my experience as a result, and I don't like this because it's not true to me, and I don't find it true. Period. And it's harmful because it negates me. That's what it is, and that's where a lot of the kind of like certain criticisms that you don't agree with comes in, because it just feels like people are trying to elucidate and illuminate and enlighten people by speaking of certain experiences, but when it comes into combat, essentially with yours, there's this sort of divide where you can't really coexist. You feel that you can't coexist, and that brings up walls. And that's the point where we gotta say, like, where people just have to exist, you know, cohabitatively, but. We're so used to kind of, you know, characterizing and categorizing certain things that we don't know what language or what filing system to kind of put those in. And that's, I think, where you know, the sort of system breaks down, because it's taken us to a kind of go-nowhere zone. So we just have to start over. But we can't really start over, because this is how we kind of communicate. So we got to kind of reverse engineer certain things. And that takes time and patience, but that's what we gotta do if we wanna interact with people with good faith and not presume that, like, they could secretly be, like, I don't know, body snatcher, putty patrollers or whatever.
Yeah. I actually don't really know where to go from here, though. So that's the. I think I've hit a dead end on my end.
That's fine. I think that, like, we've kind of, like, you know, explain the Green Book situation. The only thing I would even care to bring up is if we had any other examples of a social justice thing public thing that we didn't agree with, or something that we felt that, like, there's a lot more nuance here. But maybe if we don't, you know, this will always come up. We do this episode like every like six episodes, so So we're kind of boomerang back to it.
Well, let me just log on to Twitter real quick. I'm sure I'll find something.
I'm on my way.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, well, it's like, you know what, trying to think about like what sort of pisses me off on a daily basis. I feel like it is sort of this stuff, which is weird because shouldn't it be things that are actually important? I don't know. Like, but there's a lot of stuff that's like easy or not part of the sort of easy narrative thing, but it's like, you know, I do get really upset about mass shootings, but there's not a lot of nuance in that conversation. There aren't sides. There's just right and wrong. But with, you know, quote unquote outrage culture, it's like, well, that's about like how we talk to each other and all that stuff. And so that when, I don't know, it's just like, what's the point of everybody being on the same page? But no, it is important, but people are so frustrating. And I forgot that I'm a misanthrope anyway. So what am I even doing? But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I can't, I'm okay. Not coming up with anything.
The last thing I'll say is that like, I'm really working on this, like this presentation for this, Batman Pop Culture Conference, next April. And, I've been slotted into the sex and gender panel, which I feel was a mistake on my part, but I've been reading a lot of, the sort of history of the female characters. I was reading a lot of Lady She-Ra from her very early appearances in the late 70s, and just the other day I was reading the first several appearances of Barbara Gordon. And the theme that I feel like I'm going back towards is that these female characters really often push against the sort of patriarchal conventions of the superhero genre when they're in Batman comics. Like they exist pretty surprisingly well on their own, but whenever they kind of come up against Batman, they are kind of sort of magnetized into recognizable female tropes sooner or later. And I feel that, and I worry that that's the narrative that might run out, but I feel that tracks well often enough, because a lot of these characters can kind of carry their own stories, but like when it comes to the genre, they're kind of brought back in there. But at the same time, I'm thinking to myself, I'm not trying to demonize this genre or trying to, you know, just give a basic history lesson about, you know, thing bad in the past. It's like, I have to be a lot more original with that. And so I don't want to just end up, you know, like proselytizing and waving my finger and kind of coming off as, I'm doubting my own morality in this. And I don't believe I was doing this in sort of a cynical way initially, but I feel that like that's been the regular exercise that's kind of gotten us into that sort of, you know, easy kind of unconscious mode. And so there's rethinking these means kind of rethinking a lot of sort of our muscles in interacting with history and historical social interactions and stereotypes in that kind of way. And it's tough. It's always hard and it's always challenging and it's always confusing. But I still think it's worth doing that. I'm not resentful ultimately that I'm rendered and I'm left doing that, because I feel that like I'm just a little bit more tolerant at the end of the day.
I mean, look, I wouldn't write yourself off. I mean, you in the sort of gender sexuality category, because you are a gender, you're a man, and so I mean, but I mean, you also, I feel like you would always have something to say. And as long as there is a spectrum represented on that in that category, then, you know, that's absolutely fine. And I think you're right. And I agree with you in a sort of academic sense that, like, we should all make the effort no matter who we are. But I also kind of feel like ultimately what you're sort of reaching for possibly is like, well, how do I sort of listen? Because, like, listening is the most key part of this for guys like us. But how do I listen when I'm sort of soloing on a panel, giving a lecture? Like that's sort of a paradox, but,
flanked by two women.
Yeah. You just got to lower their microphone volumes a little bit now.
It's like taking the air out of the footballs or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. You're the Tom Brady of the Batman convention. That is, I feel like for, you know, a lot of guys like us, like the best advice we could possibly follow when it comes to our inner interface with gender topics is like to, you know, listen and also kind of withdraw a little bit. But I feel like that's kind of dangerous. I mean, I feel like that's kind of what I've been feeling lately, is like, you know what, I'm just going to not talk when I sort of feel the impulse to. Because that's the other thing, is that like a lot of a lot of this outrage culture and canceling culture and stuff like that is existent on a platform like Twitter, which is, again, like such a bastardization of human communication. It's so unnatural. Like, for all the good that it does, it's so like not how people actually talk to each other, and that can cause problems. And so for me, it's like impulse control, like relearning how to shut the fuck up and not hit the big blue button or whatever. Like, that's actually something that's been coming up for me. But you know, shouldn't you be out there talking about Lady Shiva? Like, don't, you know, because not a lot of people are. And so, like, if you have a perspective to give, then I guess it's just about like sort of finding your perspective. And that's not always going to be like shitty YouTube videos with thumbnails where it's like your face like looking angry and there's like, you know, your fucking Yuri manga, or not Yuri, but you know, your manga collection behind you and the big bold text saying like, how far will Disney push white men and all that stuff. Like, like maybe that's not like, you know, basically like the loudest fucking air horn, or not air horn, but megaphone. You know, maybe it is an academic Batman conference. Like, that's definitely not where a lot of white guys' minds are going to go in terms of like commandeering a conversation. So like, that's a good niche. And for me, it would be like whatever I'm trying to do with fiction writing, and you as well. But you know, finding the balance of my voice online when that is social capital and everything, like when that has become so important to us and our identities. It's not like a challenge in a real sense, but I think it's almost, you know, there is a call for some responsibility there that I've been neglecting because I'm a guy.
Yeah, I try more and more lately. It's easy for me to look at my writing, as appallingly egotistical as it might sound, as some sort of responsibility. Because whenever I'm like, you know, falling out of it, it's like, well, you know, a lot of people don't profess to know this. When I talk to some people, a lot of people would like to talk about this kind of stuff and would like to kind of like bring forth or at least have opinions on this, but like they don't often have it regulated in their mind in the way that, like, you know, whether it's language or certain concepts or ideas, that it's that conversation is can be a key to opening those doors of further conversation. Haha. So there, yes, I think that'll work. Oh yeah, so like before I tell you all about how awesome Shiva was in the 1980s Squetching comics, feel free to, and I mean it to Harry after that, we have this show, feel free to write in to questions we don't have answers kinoanswers@gmail.com. like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, comment on our episodes at kinoanswers.com. Basically, if you have any thoughts on the Oscars, or how we kind of navigate our way through conversation in on the minefield of people who we can do without, or people who we maybe even we think we can do without, but, you know, maybe can kind of bring forth with us into this ideal future. Yeah, please give us your thoughts. We would love to hear other thoughts, because we've kind of, you know, been playing with ourselves lately. We want to play with other people.
Oh man, nice.
Excellent. So, until that next episode, true believers, this is us, and we are saying to you, adios.